I'll also begin by saying that last night I was sitting on the dinner table, and a young woman was sitting by me, and I introduced myself, and she asked, okay, what are you going to talk about? So I said the subject, quantum creativity. And she asked, well, tell me a gist of what you're going to talk about. Obviously, she's trying to decide whether to come to the talk or not. But I said, well, but a talk on creativity, how can I tell you ahead of time? Because creativity, the experience, is distinguished by the fact that it comes with a surprise. So a talk on creativity must come as a surprise, even to the speaker. If you have a canned message, you really are missing the point. And she was surprised. Could not make anything out of it. I mean, for a speaker to give up an opportunity of speaking about what he's going to talk about is a rare event. In any case, that really is the case. The reason that creative experiences are distinguishable between our ordinary from our ordinary experiences is because they come with a surprise. But it is a little subtle, because if you have a prejudice, then of course it is not a surprise. It's a disgust. You say, when the idea comes, oh, but that cannot be. It's a red herring. Unbelievable. Incredible. It happens. Kepler, the famous German physicist who discovered that the planets move around the sun in ellipses, basic discovery of science that paved the road to Newton's discovery later. He searched for the right answer to his astronomical data on the orbit of Mars for 29 years, and this was like the 13th year of his search. And he encounters the idea. He has this idea of, look at the Greek mathematics, and Greek mathematics has a section of conic figures, generalization from the cone of a cylinder, and in that, there is the mention of a curve called ellipse. He sees it, but of course the prejudice is that got to be a circle. Got to be a circle, because that's the perfect movement, circle. So he says to himself, this is not American, so cannot say bullshit, but the English, cow dung. This is cow dung. And discards. 29 years in his search. Finally, he realizes, oh, it got to be an ellipse. This time, he says, aha, surprise. It is an ellipse after all. Okay? Now, it really is true. It really is true. It comes that way. Same thing happened to me. I, of course, grew up in India, and I was taught very early on, maybe when I was 5, by my father, who was a spiritual sort of teacher, sort of because he did other things too. And I learned about the idea that you all know, consciousness is the ground of all being. And the idea is basic in India. It's called the Vedanta or Upanishad. So I learned it. But of course, later, when I was 14, I remember the moment of decision that it's all cow dung. And I decided to be a scientist. Became a scientific materialist, and that went on for a long time. And then I came across this quantum measurement theory in a serious way. Mind you, when I was a graduate student, everybody has to go into these questions that I'll share with you. This is basic of what we learn about creativity today. But it escaped me because my mind is closed. This is Schrodinger's cat and all that stuff that you have heard about. People sort of glance through it in graduate school. We never take it very seriously because that leads to a blind alley. But then in the 70s, my life was going through a transition, so I tried to find a relevant problem in physics that would make me happy. That kind of thing led me to this quantum measurement problem, the blind alley. And I'm looking for the solution of this question. So let's get into the question at all. It's a very roundabout introduction. Forgive me for it. That's an Indian habit if you don't know. there you go. Okay, so this is the prevalent notion. Everything is just machine. This is called scientific materialism. All is matter. All is mechanical, governed by scientific laws. Matter moving in space and time, determined by material interaction. Okay? Okay, so this is a detailed picture of what it entails. What it entails is also fundamentally an assumption that is called deductionism. Matter can be broken down into littler objects. Finally, we come to what is called elementary particles, quarks and electrons. So the world is made up of those. These elementary particles make atoms, make molecules, make cells, makes brain, and brain makes consciousness. So every physicist grows up with that, and therefore, you know, consciousness is kind of a nebulous concept, a brain phenomenon. That's the way we understand it. And believe it or not, some of your theosophists may not be an exception to this because this is so prevalent. What happens is that you, of course, learn the theosophical doctrine, number one, consciousness is the ground of all being. Madame Blavatsky is very clear about it. But you may not be because you grew up in this culture, not in the 1880s culture that Madame Blavatsky was. And so you may have a juxtaposition of both beliefs, believe it or not. We often have this, and this raises conflict. This is the conflict that is called, in transpersonal psychology, the conflict of the immanent and the transcendent. The transcendent is unity, immanent is divided, separate, and we have a conflict because we see the separate world, but we want to believe in that unity. But where is that unity? We look for it. We call it universal brotherhood in theosophy, but we never find it. The fact is that if you are good to me, I'll be a brother to you or a sister to you. But if you are not, watch it. Right? And so that's where the separateness takes over, and we do not see that unity anymore, this confusion. And then it seems like, oh, consciousness must be a brain phenomenon, because why am I behaving this way? Why am I behaving this selfish way? In spite of the fact that from, you know, when I was getting into theosophy, I know universal brotherhood, right? So where is that? Where is my creative altruism that gets to universal brotherhood in my being? It doesn't happen so easily. Okay, so this is the view, and it permeates into our culture. Because a six-year-old already is getting this very interesting, quote-unquote, partial education in what is reality. But this observation comes squarely in difficulty with the ABC of quantum physics. Basic quantum physics tells you unequivocally the following thing. And there is no mistake about it, because myriad experiments support this statement. Quantum objects, which means all objects of nature, all material objects, at least, are waves of possibility. They are not objects in the sense of that mechanical duck. They are not objects whose movement can be predicted. They're objects of possibility. What does that mean? That means that they can do unusual things as possibility. That also means, because we never observe them as possibility, that whenever we observe them, our observation must be converting these possibilities into actual events of experience. These two things. So an electron in possibility, and this is what quantum physics says literally, absolutely believe it literally, if I drop an electron over here at rest, it won't stay at rest, like Newton said. Instead, quantum physics says unequivocally, verified, immediate experiment, don't doubt it, although it's like that incredible, you know, hard to believe. The way to believe it is that, look, you cannot question reality. This is the way it is. You've got to believe it. So the electron, instead of staying at rest, spreads all over the room. Possibility. But if we set a three-dimensional grid of electron counters, Geiger counters, then not all the Geiger counters will tick. Possibility, remember, it's not impossibility, it's everywhere. But when we put Geiger counters to measure where the electron actually is in a given observation, we find it localized as a particle. The wave somehow converts into a particle of actuality. What did it? Who did it? This question becomes paramount because of a mathematical theorem that says that no material interactions can do it. No material interactions can convert a wave of possibility into a particle of actuality at a given point. So who does it? Who does it? This is called the quantum measurement problem. It's also called the observer effect, because in the presence of the observer, this has to happen because the observer never sees a possibility. You cannot say that of the Geiger counter, because you cannot know without you checking the Geiger counter that it actually ticked. So we say Geiger counter is also a bunch of possibilities when it encounters the electron at various places. All the Geiger counters are ticking in possibility. But which one will actually tick? That is determined by the human observer. What is the magic of the observer? So you look around, what does the observer have? Obviously, none of the common characteristics does it. Then you have a brainwave, you say, well, it has to be our consciousness. Because it's the consciousness that is looking, and it is indeed true that we have that facility. We look and we have an experience of I look. That cannot be denied either. And this I look is also very mysterious. In fact, if we analyze, we immediately find, this is interesting. Because this I, that is also seemed to be outside of the purview of the scientific materialist worldview. Analyze it. Atoms make molecules, make cells, make brain. But these are all objects. Objects always make objects. I is something qualitatively different. It's a subject. It's what is experiencing, right? I can make it into an object and talk about it as an object, but I know that when I talk about the I, I'm not talking about the object. It's the experiencer, something that I cannot quite describe, but we sort of try to describe it as saying that I had a subjective experience. I had a subjective experience with a specific way that I look, Amit looks, or Betty looks, our team looks, but it's not that the same way that everybody looks. It's not objective. Everybody has a felt experience, a qualia, that's the technical word of philosophers, that is outside the purview of scientific materialism. Cognitive psychology still struggles with this paradox of perception. How does this I, this individual experience, unique subjective experience arise? Same event, quantum measurement. So the quantum physicists is worrying about how does the object becomes material, and the cognitive psychologist is worrying how does the subject arise when these quantum possibilities become actualities. Same problem, same wonderful solution. But you have to make the transition. So brain phenomenon, paradox, because material interactions cannot do it. If brain is consciousness, obviously consciousness would not be able to convert anything. It's material interactions. Brain interacting with an object, material interaction, cannot convert possibility into actuality. So we turn to the other side of the coin, another worldview, which is the religious worldview, which is the worldview that is we call dualism. God does it, right? In summary, I mean, you can say it in much more philosophically sophisticated way, thinking that, oh, this is better because I'm not using the G word. But it's really not. It's really not. If you say mind does it, if you say consciousness does it, so long as you're positing dualism, there will always be this question that will haunt you. And the question is simple. It has to be non-material because that one which does it obviously cannot follow the rules of quantum physics. If it did, it would also consist of possibilities. So it must be non-physical, non-material. And then the question, how does a non-material consciousness interact with matter? How does non-matter interact with matter? It cannot without a mediator. Try it. That's why we cannot communicate with ghosts. So, problem this way, problem that way. Which way to go? This is the question that I'm dealing with. 5 years passes, so I have an inkling that maybe mystics know. So I'm hobnobbing with mystics. And I visit quite a few of them. And they tell me all these ideas, their ideas about the world, consciousness is the ground of all being, that one, nothing but God. I, of course, read the Bible by then, of course, Vedanta and all this, and the same kind of thing, which I had rejected as a youth, but I still could not quite get it. How can that be? Cow dung, bullshit. By that time, I had picked up the American slang. And then one evening, I am talking with this mystic, Joel Marwood, and we get into the same argument. I'm sort of a little high-handedly because I'm the physicist, he's just he used to be a filmmaker. What do they know? But still, he is very intelligent, so I have respect for him. So we automatically get this to this problem. Quantum measurement problem. And I'm saying, well, you know, it cannot be brain phenomenon, obviously, paradox. It cannot be dualistic, paradox. So how to solve this thing? And Joel says, you have scientific blinder on your eyes. And that aggravates me. But he continues, he says, is consciousness before the brain or brain before the consciousness? Brain before consciousness. Now, that may sound a little obscure to you, but, you know, physicists have encountered such concepts. It's called non-locality. Non-locality is an idea that it's all transcendent of the individual space and individual time. So two events at different times can coexist simultaneously. Two things of different space can coexist simultaneously. And that kind of thing is the non-local, you can call it a non-local transfer of information. And we have become, by that time, vaguely aware of that is being a quantum fact. Because in 1982, I'm talking about a 1985 conversation with Joel. 1982, Alana Speck actually verified that, yes, such a domain, such a transcendent non-local domain of reality actually exists. Is that non-local domain the domain of potentiality of quantum physics? That's the part that was not identified as of yet. Nobody did that. So non-locality I knew. So I throw out smugly that, oh, you're just talking about non-locality. I know all about it. I know much more than you do. Little insult. But Joel is undaunted. He repeated, you have scientific blinders. Amit, there is nothing but God, he says. Translating a Sufi saying, actually, there is nothing but God. Now, I've heard it before, right? I've read Jesus. The kingdom of God is everywhere. People don't see it. Blinders, right? Cow dung. That's the way I have rejected it. Bullshit. But this time, a different response took place. I was very surprised with my malleability. Mind became flexible. I still remember. Mind became very flexible. It's like it's melting. Consciousness is no longer solid, rigid. You know, people talk about breakthrough. There's a 17th century woodcut. You might have seen it. A monk is breaking through the wood and going to the other side. Plato talks about it in the allegory of Plato's cave. Today we have out-of-the-box thinking. You are in a box and you break through. And you certainly do out-of-the-box thinking. And literally that's what happened to me. It was an enormous, instead of that rejection, automatic, bullshit, nonsense, an acceptance. Yes, it can be that way. And if it is that way, I'm exactly that way. The concept came like I'm stammering. And if it is that way, then I can understand Jesus, I can understand the Hindus, I can understand the Christian, Buddhist, everyone who is talking like in this very colorful and riddleful, including the theosophist, consciousness is the ground of being. These kind of things start making sense. How is oneness? We don't see oneness, people are different. How is the oneness? Oneness belongs to this domain of potentiality. It's not oneness here. That's the mistake that we make. This world is a world of appearance that appears to be separate. Beyond that is a world which is the world of potentiality, which is the real reality, which is quantum reality, which is what quantum physics is telling us by then for more than 50 years. Quantum physics was discovered in 1925. I learned quantum physics when I was in college. That was in 1956. In all those years, nobody mentioned that this is what quantum physics requires. And finally, when conversing with a mystic, a filmmaker, I get it. It can be that way. Huge surprise. It can be that way because consciousness is the ground of being and the whole interpretation has to come to apply to the domain of potentiality, not what we see in what mystics call the immanent reality. Mystics also call it appearance. Sometimes they get overboard. They go overboard, it's true, They call it illusion. It's not illusion exactly, because it obeys science, it obeys regularity. Anything that obeys regularity could not be trivial illusion in that sense, but it is appearance regardless. It's not reality. If reality is all connected, then connection is reality. Interconnection is reality. But and the separateness is illusory and appearance. And that's the understanding. So for theosophists, we are half step ahead of the conventional people. It is the advantage of being a theosophist, because you already have the concept of universal brotherhood, but the concept has to be complemented. If you think of that universal brotherhood as local interactions, then you'll fall short, because how many theosophists do you meet and how many theosophists can you love? All right, you love those people who come to Wheaton regularly. Can you love those people who are in Bangalore or little village, especially in India, who are very different than you culturally and physically and every which way? Not so easy, right? So the local connections only can begin the process. It's a non-local, through consciousness, the ground of being, domain of potentiality, possibility, that will get you to understand universal brotherhood. And the process for that is what is called creativity. Okay? All making sense? This is why we talk about creativity. So, in this way, so this picture is interesting because the ancient people saw it as a light, and they called it downward causation, coming from the transcendent. And then it was translated downward causation from a dualistic god. Christianity did that in the popular rendition, which moved away from Jesus and more into the Old Testament, which is still local, not non-local. Jesus talks about non-locality constantly. Okay, this is the quantum measurement solution in actual language. So we say when you look, we collapse electrons wave and wave of possibility in transcendent potential becomes a particle of actuality. Okay, so far so good. How does it become a particle of actuality? This is the part where that surprise of creative experiences find an actual physical reason for why the surprise. In quantum physics we find, and this discovery was pretty early on, 1913, Niels Bohr, the great Danish physicist, he had this dream. In a dream, he found that the atom is like a solar system. It's a teeny, teeny, teeny solar system. The atoms move in orbits around the atomic nucleus, electrons, and just like the solar system, planets move around the sun. And in order to make it consistent with physics, with experimental data, he had to make a strange assertion that when an electron jumps from one atomic orbit to another, they don't go through the intervening space. Surprise of surprises. They don't go through the intervening space. Instead, said Bohr, they make a quantum leap. This phrase, quantum leap, is now commonplace because you use it to describe that aha surprise of creative experience. There is a quantum leap. So I was taking a quantum leap when I thought of the solution of the quantum measurement problem. Because if consciousness is the ground of being and it makes a choice from the possible positions that the electron has in the room to an actual position where the Geiger counter will tick, right? And that happens discontinuously. This change of possibility actuality comes discontinuously, just as my change in the thought from the mundane thought of rejecting the idea to not only accepting the idea but understanding it fully, the total import of it, is an aha surprise. It is that way. I finally could not only accept but really understand. It is that way. Consciousness is the ground of being, and it is that way. Objects are possibilities within consciousness, and it is that way. You cannot question how is it that way. You cannot question how is consciousness the ground of being. How does that make sense? After all, we have grown up with the idea of consciousness being a brain phenomenon. How can it be the origin of everything? You cannot question the fundamental metaphysics of the world. It is that way. Just as the mystics have said to us on the basis of what they have experienced, they have intuited. It is that way. Just as Madame Blavatsky wrote as the first doctrine of theosophy. It is that way. So this is the thing. Now you have that it is that way as from a doctrine, from a belief system, into a science. Why is it now science? Because if it is that way, then if this non-local consciousness is really a non-local consciousness, a quantum consciousness, then it gives us a verifiable idea. This non-locality of quantum consciousness can be verified. Why? Because in the event of measurement, what is actually taking place? We are also identifying with the brain. This consciousness is identifying with the brain, obviously. And because of that identity, it is having that subjective experience. I see this object. I see this electron revealing itself at the Geiger counter. I am hearing the tick. I am measuring the electron. This I has come about. How does it come about? Because the same brain of the observer was a possibility before observation. So in reality, there is no observer looking. The observer, a possible observer, was looking at a possible electron. In the process of looking, the observer became materialized just as the electron became actualized. And the observer says, I am looking. The observer and the electron arise in actuality simultaneously. Buddhist call is dependent co-arising. Subject and object arise together in our experience. They are a pair. There never is an object without a subject looking at it. Not only that, experience. This is what experience is about. There is no world without an experience. There is no world without an experiencer arising simultaneously with the objects of experience. Fundamental. Cognitive paradox solved at the same time as the quantum measurement paradox. So all this is wonderful, and the quantum leap is wonderful, because that explains the aha surprise of creative experiences. So we can now take this quite seriously, that yes, creativity is quantum creativity. So what is it that's telling us about creativity that is so wonderful? What is telling us that, look, before we process things in a conscious way, objects are possibilities. All objects. The world consists of material experiences, but it also consists of mental experience and vital energy experiences and intuitive experiences, and we have various names for it. We say when we think thoughts. So thoughts have to be identified as objects of experience, and the thinker, of course, is the subject. Similarly, we say we feel. Well, feeling is a little bit more complex. Theosophists understood it because they have very beautifully, you know, if you look at the Upanishad, you get five worlds of experience. The first one is experience of matter, and then they have vital energy, and then they have mental thought, and then they have archetypal intuition. Archetype is a word that Plato used, but Hindus and Kabbalah did not use the word archetype, but that's a different story. Plato's name is better, so I'll use the objects of intuition as archetypes, like truth, beauty, love, those things. By the way, I'm so impressed with theosophists. One young man was putting the microphone on me, and his name is Truth. I have seen women named Beauty, which is beautiful, but Truth, congratulations, what a wonderful name to carry. So these are archetypes. Archetypes, why? Because we don't quite know what truth is. So archetypes are stuff that we intuit what they are, but we cannot say. Remember that story in the Bible? Pilate asked Jesus about truth, and so Jesus throws the question back. What is truth? He doesn't say. He knows. Archetypes, we cannot give a definition. We can talk about them, but not define them. So these are the objects plus, of course, the self, the I, which we call consciousness. These are the five. But theosophists are so clever. Madame Blavatsky has seven. Quantum physics has an explanation for that, finally. I understood it after many, many years, only recently, why seven is much more appropriate. Okay, so I have to go through a little bit more to come to that. So let's do that. This I like. Isn't that nice to have a turnabout? It's consciousness that does matter, not the other way around, okay? This is called a gestalt picture, okay? This is called a gestalt picture. Why? Because there are two meanings of it. One is a young woman, and the other is an old woman. Some of you are seeing the young, some of you are seeing the old, okay? Now, if you're seeing one, you can see the other eventually by shifting your perspective. So the artist called this picture, interestingly, my wife and my mother-in-law. Irritating for mother-in-laws, perhaps, but you learn to be tolerant of these things, little insults at your wrinkles. Okay, so it's a change in perspective. That's the important thing about the both creativity and about quantum measurement. So when we are saying that we measure the electron here, not there, it's a change in our perspective. We are not doing anything to the electron. The conventional assumption is that you have to have a force to do something to the electron. We said that no, it's just a choice. I'm just choosing the perspective of my looking, that's all. Creativity, that becomes very, very important. This is the absolutely crucial thing. You change your perspective. And that may be harder than you think. You have this mother-in-law. You don't have particular affinity towards this word mother-in-law. That's why mother-in-law, right? You have to find the other. Find the other. Universal brotherhood. But every brother has a mother-in-law inside him. Every sister has that too. We all have that bitchy part. Not acceptable. The other. Sometimes in Greek mythology it's called the Janus problem. You have to look at two with two faces. One face is the good, the other face is the evil, and somehow they have to be integrated. How do I love somebody who has this mother-in-law inside of that person, right? How do you do it? Okay? Opposites have to be put together. So it all has to be done with this consciousness, which includes everything. inclusive consciousness, the I that is we. If the person, if the mother-in-law person is also me, surely everybody can love oneself. Some people can't, so that's the first barrier to creatively loving someone. You have to love yourself. This is why all the traditions, like Jesus says, love God as you love yourself. If you cannot love yourself, you cannot love God. But the assumption is that we could, in principle, and we do, in principle, love ourselves. We do accept. Have you noticed? You have a little bit of guilt occasionally, and then the guilt passes. You accept, okay, I will have reactions. I will have separateness. But ultimately, I am okay. But to transfer that is you are okay also is more difficult. That's what we are getting at. That's the universal brotherhood. Okay, so how do we experiment this? This should be helpful, because if universal brotherhood is solidly established, non-local aspect of universal brotherhood is solidly established on experimental data, that helps. Because then I know that it is not only a theory of quantum physics that there is this non-local consciousness, the domain of potentiality, but it's also experimental fact. I can actually use it. It's available to me as well as to these people who participated in this experiment. What is the experiment? Two people, Jacobo Greenberg, a neurophysiologist at the University of Mexico, figured out that if they meditate, they may have this quantum ability of communicating through this non-local domain of potentiality. So two brains, separated by what is called Faraday cages. So these two brains, the only difference between these two brains and ordinary brains is that these two brains have meditated together with the intention that we will communicate directly. We will communicate without signal. Quantum communication, non-local communication. Non-local, it's the same thing. No signal is needed, right? Agreed? If you're communicating with yourself, no signal is needed. And that's the experimental data that we already had in 1982, that there are communications between objects that requires no signal, instantaneous. That is what is called non-locality, signal-less communication. These people are verifying that for the brains. Can two brains communicate without signals? How to prove it? You put them in Faraday cages. These two people, these two brains. And these individual brains are connected to electroencephalogram machines which measure the brain waves, and you look at the brain waves. Are the brain waves similar? Is the brain acting in the same kind of state? Difficult, but we can do it. How we do it is, now how they did it first, and now some 24 experiments have replicated the data. What they did is to put electrodes on each brain and connect the electrodes to an electroencephalogram machine. The idea is that the machines will pick up brain waves, and if you feed one brain some light flashes, there's a unique signature of what will happen to that brain. It's called evoked potential. That's what we show in the upper left. Evoked potential. Potential, like potential in the occipital area of that brain, which has been evoked by the light flashes. Specific signature. Event-related potential. Light flashes have caused this. So it just could not be like accidental. It could not be a chance thing. It is specific signature. So, the other observer is sitting in a Faraday cage. No electromagnetic waves are permitted to go from here to there. So nobody can claim that, well, somehow electromagnetic field, same field everywhere, and so that's what the observer is picking up. No, because the other observer is sitting inside this Faraday cage, metallic cage. Electromagnetic waves cannot go through. Signal-less communication. Does the other observer's brain pick up? The transfer potential is really when you juxtapose them, very similar in phase and strength to the Evoque potential. 71% overlap, says a computer. Way beyond chance, could not be chance. So what's the conclusion? Two observers at a distance are communicating without signal simply by intending that let there be universal brotherhood between us. This is that simple. You're sitting with a person who has a mother-in-law inside, him or her, and you just intend, let there be universal brotherhood. Let there be direct communication between me and this person. And that intention, in theosophy there is a phrase. Amazing, amazing system. There is a phrase called will prayer. Will prayer. Have you heard the word will prayer? It's in the theosophy literature, will prayer. Amazing concept. So intention works like a will prayer. This is a different kind of will. We talk about willpower all the time. That's how we try to do it. I will will myself to overcome my dislike of this person and smile at him or her anyway. And the smile is toothy and it's just not working. It's not ear to ear. It's not showing in the eye. But at least I'm trying. So we say, we're human beings. We can only try to be universally brother or sister. You cannot really do it. That's not humanly possible. No, you have to give up willpower. What you do instead is will prayer. You say that I intend, that's the first step, and then you relax. When you relax, what happens is that you are not you anymore. You are that which you are seeking, universal consciousness. You are that brotherhood already. And in that brotherhood, there is acceptance of the mother-in-law as well as the good in the other person. And it is this that you are opening to. All of a sudden, communication happens, and you have a signal. Transferred potential. You have done it. You feel it. Where do you feel it? We feel it in our heart. Now it is literal, really. I'll tell you how in a second. Okay, so we need to talk about this one. So the mystery of all this is that brain is making a self as it is measuring a quantum object. That is the mystery of all this. How does the observer become manifest in the brain? How is it that brain can make a representation of that which is reality? Traditions say all kinds of good stuff, but we don't understand it. Traditions say God makes human beings in his or her own image. Sounds good, but how does God do it? That's where we get stuck. How does God do it? We have simplified matters a little bit. Well, God does it because God is really not separate from us. So that's the first hurdle to overcome. Quantum measurement problem already has overcome that hurdle for you. Theosophical doctrine is now alive. It's experimentally verified. It's non-local consciousness. That's what is being. It's not separate from us. It is, we are part of it. Now that part is okay. But how does it actually do it? It's still a little bit mysterious. Why the brain? What is in the brain that is different than the Geiger counter? That part is the difficult part. What is it in the brain that is different from the Geiger counter? Geiger counter could not do it. The rock cannot do it. But we do it. So what does the brain have? So one way of thinking about this is like this drawing hand. Now that's a little bit, still a little bit obscure. So let me take you through a sentence that's called a liar sentence. I am a liar. Think about this sentence a little bit. You will get something peculiar about this sentence. I am a liar. If I am a liar, then I am telling the truth. Lo and behold, but if I am telling the truth, then I am a liar. If I am a liar, telling the truth. Come back again to the definition of I. But then I am a liar, so come back again to that liar. But if I am a liar, then I am telling the truth. Go on and on and on ad infinitum. You are caught in this sentence. So that's how the brain does it. Brain has what in the language of these logicians is called a tangled hierarchy. Instead of that simple hierarchy of elementary particles making atoms, making molecules in a simple way, we have a tangled hierarchy of circular logic. You make me, I make you. Drawing hands. One hand draws the other hand draws the one hand. Neither one can say that I'm the origin. Neither one is head honcho. They're making each other. Dependent co-arising. Krishnamurti, some of you have heard Krishnamurti. Krishnamurti used to use very dramatic language. The observer is the observed. He knew. The observer is the observed. So in this way, tangled hierarchically, the brain captures consciousness. What produces in the brain this phenomenon? A tangled hierarchy of two apparatuses. One we can call the perception apparatus, the other one we can call the memory-making apparatus. And this is a common thing, everybody knows that. Perception requires memory, memory requires perception. So how they can co-create? They co-create little by little. Like think of a shoelace, little by little. A little shoelace goes into one hole, and then little, other hole, little, little. But notice that little things will not do it. Eventually you have to go to infinite, ad infinitum, then only, right? So the tangled hierarchy is fundamentally different from simple hierarchy in the sense that we cannot do it continuously. We have to do it in a discontinuous fashion eventually. So tangled hierarchy involves a discontinuity. Surprise of surprises. How could the brain be made? So we conclude that yes, 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 people who say that God makes it is correct. We cannot make it in the laboratory. It's outside of the human domain of making, because humans can only make things little by little. That it's in our God consciousness which has to come through to produce something that is truly discontinuous in the brain. So we realize that human brains, stuff like that, or even a single cell which is alive, is really fundamentally different from what is non-alive and non-sentient. We cannot make it like the materialists have pictured, that it's all continuous. We make all the way from elementary particles to the brain. No, brain cannot be broken down to elementary particles. There is a discontinuity in the brain. It has to be, otherwise brain could not capture consciousness and we would not have a self. Brain has a fundamental discontinuity built into it. How can we make such a system? We can make such a system only by creativity, through a discontinuous quantum leap. And we cannot do it with the human consciousness. We have to depend on this God consciousness for that kind of creative leap. Indeed, all creative leaps are action of that God consciousness. Only thing that is different from the spiritual dualistic tradition, not the spiritual mystical tradition, but spiritual dualistic tradition, which you call religion, is that religions think of God as separate from us, a dualistic God. If we can give up that idea to accept the theosophical idea of God being us, because it's consciousness, and it's just God consciousness, human consciousness. God consciousness we call the one, human consciousness we call the separate self, ego. Okay? And creativity is the interplay of this God consciousness, which makes the those things that that requires discontinuity, and versus human consciousness, which is the continuous work. So how does creative altruism, this idea that theosophists posit for everyday life, how does that work? It works in this way. We do with human consciousness what we can. Use the local part. Use the local part to love bit by bit. Okay? But you cannot do it bit by bit. A very violent criminal was finally taken captive, put in jail. But this criminal, as is not uncommon, is also a devout Christian. He develops he had a wound. The police man who captured him actually shot him. So he had a wound in his right leg, and it became gangrenous. So the surgeon had to cut it off. And being a religious Christian, he says, I want the leg for proper burial. The jail authority said, okay, sure. So the friend comes and picks up the leg. But because this criminal is very, very violent, he has a guard on his prison cell. The guard doesn't know the arrangement, so guard is looking at very suspiciously that this fellow comes and picks up a leg in a bag from this guy. In a few days, the guy develops a gangrene also in his left leg, the other leg. Whoops. The surgeon has to cut it off. Again, he brings it to his cell. Again, the friend comes in the evening and picks it up. This time, the guard just cannot help himself. He becomes super suspicious. What is this fellow doing? So he just blurts out, what are you doing? Are you trying to escape or something? Leg by leg, arm by arm. No, you cannot escape like that. It's all or nothing. All or nothing. So what happens with creative altruism is that eventually we have to love all, including the mother-in-law, right? So all or nothing. So how does it work? How it works in creativity research, we say that we do our share. We do the preparation part, the local part. We do our best. We don't succeed. Okay? And then we surrender. We relax. In relaxation, the creativity researchers show that indeed it is true that when you are not consciously working, this is the mystery of creativity, the one single mystery that you really have to learn. I have to learn, you have to learn, everybody who wants to be creative has to learn. There are natural creatives who already know. They just do it innately through their intuition. And that is to relax after you have done your work. The first phase of creativity is called preparation. Next phase is called incubation. Bird sits on its egg, doing nothing, like that Zen code, sitting quietly doing nothing. Spring comes and the grass grows by itself. The grass grows by itself. You don't have to do anything. It happens, it comes. I remember the same evening that my breakthrough came, I was in the afternoon, I was in Ojai, California. In the afternoon, Krishnamurti was talking at the oak grove. And there was a heckler. Heckler in the sense that he was just asking you one naughty question which every theosophist would ask. He's asking, but you always talk about just be there and observe. How do we observe, sir? We never get this presence that you talk about. It doesn't come to us. And Krishnamurti, I still remember, it reverberates in my ear when I tell this story. Krishnamurti, for a minute or so, just looks at the fellow. And then he says, with such gravity that the audience just is listening, including myself, just pin drop. There's total quietness. And he says, it must come. It must come. So when you wait with this feeling of total surrender. It must come. This non-local consciousness must cooperate. You see, it just happens. It will have to happen. It's inevitable that you will get universal brotherhood, unconditional love. The mother-in-law is forgiven. It happens. And that's the moment of human life that Madame Blavatsky was praying for, that we all pray for. But we pray for with intention, will prayer. We put our bit in. We have to do our part. Creativity comes to the prepared mind. So we do our part, and God must come. The one must come. The unity, diversity riddle has to solve within ourselves. And it does resolve. Then, all becomes wonderful. Okay? So let me just take you through a little bit more, but it is, okay. Sometimes we call this experience the quantum self-experience. Because this experience is a very unique one. It comes with a surprise and discontinuity and all that. Obviously, it's different from the ego, which has all this other stuff that we need. And notice that it's complementary in creativity. Don't get the impression that I'll just wait and get it. That's the approach of The Secret. It's a movie and a book, but it's nonsense. You don't get it just waiting. You have to supplement it with your effort. So it's both the ego and the quantum self. So this is the thing that, you know, we have like a paper dragon. We try to do it and try to do it. You know, this dragon is trying to transcend the paper on which it is drawn, but of course it can't. So you have to surrender the dragon, which goes on seeing, trying to do it all by yourself. This is the other side of secret. There is this secret part to people who just relax and not do anything and think that God will provide. And then the other side where you just do like the scientists, and never happens either that way. So the answer is that you have to combine preparation, incubation, certain insight, and then manifestation. Okay? Certain insight is the quantum leap. Incubation is the unconscious processing. God processes in the unconscious, in the domain of possibility, which is unconsciousness. That's where the processing, main processing goes on. That's where opposites are combined, because opposites are possible to exist. If there are potentiality, they can coexist. This is the thing that you have to see. Mother-in-law becomes okay in possibility. In possibility, we can permit complete opposites, truth and untruth. We can permit CNN and Fox News. They're both okay. And that, in that okayness, we learn to love the Republicans. We learn to love everyone. It's okay to have differences. All right? God reaching out to the human, but not quite touching it. We can never touch the unconscious, because that's the definition of the unconscious. We cannot be conscious. So you can never meet God face to face, but that's good. Very important recognition. Conflicts, yes, we can That's the recognition of the dagger and the olive branch simultaneously, the mother and the mother-in-law simultaneously. Okay, this is the final message. Do be, do be, do. Simple, but says it all. Combine do and be, and you will be situated in universal brotherhood.